We've offered this class in semesters prior to taking an Israel trip as a precursor for people going on that trip. That being said, the information, I took biblical backgrounds in seminary 15 years before I ever made it to Israel. And so it's, you don't have to go to Israel in order for an understanding of the biblical world to be valuable to you. Ultimately, we're all trying to read an ancient Near Eastern text as 21st century Western thinkers, and we are foreigners when it comes to the Bible. We're closer to a first century Roman than we are, a 2,000 years B.C. Mesopotamian like Abraham was, but we're foreigners when it comes to the biblical text culturally, linguistically, politically, and so anything that we can understand about that world is going to help us read in context better, which makes the study of biblical backgrounds valuable to anybody who really takes seriously their interpretation of the Bible. So that's the focus of the course this semester. Garrett Robinson and myself will be co-teaching. I'll be in here more often than not. I don't have any kids playing football this fall, so I don't have Wednesday nights, scampering off to go watch a middle school or a JV football game. It is both celebration and kind of sad at the same time. But anyways, we're going to get started with a conversation just about the ancient Near Eastern world. When we talk about biblical backgrounds, we'll date Abraham, that's kind of where we start our more concrete dating, to what's referred to as the Middle Bronze Period. Middle Bronze Period, which is around 2000 to maybe 1600 BC. And so if you're trying to pinpoint Abraham on a timeline, just round numbers, we lock Abraham in around 2000 BC. And so we're talking about from Abraham to the end of the New Testament, from 2000 BC to around 100 AD, 2100 years. In other words, about the same amount of history that we have from the time of Jesus until now. It's a lot of history. And we can say we're going to deal with the history of the biblical world, but we're covering the rise and fall of empires that would take place over centuries. We're talking about cultural changes, that would take place over centuries. When you study world history, there's a lot more to study between the time of Christ and now because we have a lot more information and knowledge about the last 2,000 years than we did the 2,000 years preceding that. But that's kind of the time period that we're working with. The Old Testament roughly spans from 2,000 BC to 400 BC. Then you have a dark period, the 400 years in which you'll find the rise of the Greek Empire. Spread of Hellenism lands in between the Testaments. And then, of course, when we enter the New Testament world, Rome has supplanted Greece as the primary empire in the ancient Near Eastern European world. And so we're covering 21 years of history and the kingdoms and nations and cultures that would rise and fall during that time. So obviously, the Bible doesn't start with Abraham. The Bible has 11 chapters at the beginning. That is, we don't know how much time. It's a tug of war sometimes between science, scientific methods, scientific models, biblical interpreters. Could be thousands of years, could be hundreds of thousands of years, could be millions of years. Depends on who you ask. From a study of human civilization's point of view, we kind of start tracking human civilization around 3,000 BC, 1,000 years before the time of Abraham. And so that gives us a window for some of those predecessors, some of those figures in Genesis 1 through 11 to kind of have a home. And sometimes, settlements, human civilizations, they'll study back as far as 3,000 to 6,000 BC from an archaeology point of view. What that means is, we might can date city ruins or temples or, artifacts to 6,000 BC, but with the rise of writing, reading, laws, literacy, we start identifying human civilization in a different scope around 3,000 BC. And so Let's put up, you got the maps handy there, Mike? If you can put up map number one. These are maps that are pulled right out of the Holman Bible Atlas. We're going to put them on the screen tonight, just because you don't have books yet, and I didn't want to make, we don't have color copies, they're expensive. But if you have a Bible, or if you even want to pull up on your Google Maps or your Apple Maps and track over to the Western Mediterranean, I'm sorry, the Eastern Mediterranean, you're going to find this stretch of land. If I don't know how well you can see that, but you can tell that the little black dots on that map kind of start down at the bottom, you know, kind of center left, and then track up. And then once you get up there where the mountain range kicks in, they kind of turn and follow downwards into the east. It makes a crescent, and you may have to go all the way back to like sixth grade world history to remember the description of the Fertile Crescent. But that's this, you know, land that we often give credit for being the birth of human civilization. And the reason why this area is the birth of human civilization, Mike's making me stay in front of the iPad. What is the one commodity that you have to have in order for communities to exist? You got to have water, have to. And in that area, we see the Delta region of the Nile, which is one of the great rivers of the world. And then by the time we get over here to the mountains, we're tracking the Tigris and Euphrates rivers down towards the Persian Gulf. So that's two of the other major rivers in the world. And then we've got the Mediterranean Sea, the Red Sea, the Persian Gulf. You've got large bodies of water. Water dictated where people would settle, where they would build, where they would farm, where they had access to food. And that's why this area is kind of referred to as the cradle of human civilization. When you think of the Fertile Crescent, from an ancient point of view, we identify this area with three geographical monikers. One of them is Mesopotamia, one of them is Egypt, and then one of them is the land in between. One of them is the land in between. Egypt, we know, world empires, major, you know, major player. Mesopotamia, we know as well, but Mesopotamia, where Egypt is both a region and a country, Mesopotamia, there was never a Mesopotamian empire. Mesopotamia wasn't the name of a city, it wasn't the name of a nation, it wasn't the name of an empire. Mesopotamia was the region out of which the Sumerian Empire would exist, the Akkadian Empire would exist, the Babylonian Empire would exist, the Assyrian Empire would exist. All four of those major world empires were in the region of Mesopotamia. The word Mesopotamia, mezo, is the word for middle or in between, and the word potamia refers to the rivers. You hear the same word in one of our animals. Did you know this is what a hippopotamus is? It's a river monster. Potamus and hippopotamus is the same word that we find in Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia speaks to the land between the rivers, or the land of the rivers. And so it's the region simply there tracking along the Tigris and Euphrates. I think map number two, scroll through 1A, and if you get to map number two, or if you're on a maps device on your, or a maps program on your device, you can see kind of the modern world. Egypt is still a modern country. Mesopotamia largely is comprised of Syria and Iraq. It does kind of those, where those rivers dump into the Persian Gulf is right where Kuwait is located. If you want to go take a river cruise along the Euphrates, you'd start in Syria. That may be our next big trip. We may do a Syria, Iraq, Kuwait river cruise. I don't know if those are options or not, but I would, that would be an adventure to say the least. The Nile is going to be down here where Egypt is, dumps, and the Nile flows south to north, unlike most of our other rivers. It flows, as you're looking in the map, it flows up into the Mediterranean Sea. The land in between, if you've got Fertile Crescent, you've got Mesopotamia in the north and Egypt in the south, it shouldn't be a surprise that these two locations of major world development, you can't just travel from Egypt to Mesopotamia because you have that big Arabian desert in between them. And the one place that you could use to travel between the two parts of the world was the little land bridge where modern-day Israel is located. We refer to that in ancient geographical terms as the Levant, L-E-V-A-N-T, Levant. You may have heard of peoples or areas in that region referred to as Levantine. That's what they're speaking to. They're not speaking to a single country any more so than Mesopotamia is. They're speaking to the geographical region. The Levant in much of the biblical world was comprised of Canaan, Israel, Palestine to the south, depending on who was predominating during the particular time period, and then Syria to the north. Or along the coast, this would be the Phoenicians. You hear Tyre and Sidon as cities referenced often. You'll hear about the Cedars of Lebanon referred to often. Lebanon is the modern country. Syria kind of runs a lot of that territory, but then the coastal area along the Mediterranean is Lebanon. Syria is a place very tumultuous. You probably don't want to go there. Lebanon, you can travel there. Americans do. It's supposedly quite beautiful, great food, very much a Middle Eastern location. None of those countries typically get along with Israel very well. You can travel from Israel into Jordan much more easily than you can Israel going obviously into Syria or Lebanon. But that's kind of the landscape of the world. So I've got a little 4-minute video on Mesopotamia that's going to describe some in colorful language with pictures a little bit, easier than I could. If by any chance you're on Facebook Live, if you can open up another window, or if you want to open up your YouTube app, go to YouTube, search Mesopotamia 101. This is a National Geographic video. It's a little 4-minute intro to the empires of Mesopotamia, kings, developments out of that world. And so you can track over there to YouTube. I don't know that you'll be able to see it from our feed, but you can pull it up on your own in YouTube.
The story of civilization itself begins in one place. Not Egypt, not Greece, not Rome, but Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia is an exceedingly fertile plain situated between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers. For 5 millennia, this small strip of land situated in what is today Iraq, Kuwait, and Syria fostered innovations that would change the world forever. Inhabited for nearly 12,000 years, Mesopotamia's stable climate, rich soil, and steady supply of fresh water made it ideal for agriculture to develop and thrive. About 6,000 years ago, seemingly overnight, some of these agricultural settlements blossomed into some of the world's first cities. In the period between 4,000 and 3,100 BC, Mesopotamia was dotted with a constellation of competing city-states. At one point, they were unified under the Akkadian Empire and then broke apart, forming the empires of Assyria and Babylon. Despite near-constant warfare, innovation and development thrived in ancient Mesopotamia. They built on a monumental scale, from palaces to ziggurats. Mammoth temples served as ritual locations to commune with the gods. They also developed advanced mathematics, including a base 60 system that created a 60-second minute, a 60-minute hour, and a 360-degree circular angle. The Babylonians used their sophisticated system of mathematics to map and study the sky. They divided one Earth year into 12 periods. Each was named after the most prominent constellations in the heavens, a tradition later adopted by the Greeks to create the zodiac. They also divided the week into 7 days, naming each after their 7 gods embodied by the 7 observable planets in the sky. But perhaps the most impactful innovation to come out of Mesopotamia is literacy. What began as simple pictures scrawled onto wet clay to keep track of goods and wealth developed into a sophisticated writing system by the year 3200 BC. This writing system would come to be called cuneiform in modern times and proved so flexible that, over the span of 3,000 years, it would be adapted for over a dozen different major languages and countless uses, including recording the law of the Babylonian king Hammurabi, which formed the basis of a standardized justice system. But Mesopotamia's success became its undoing. Babylon, in particular, proved too rich a state to resist outside envy. In 539 BC, the Persian king Cyrus conquered Babylon and sealed his control over the entirety of Mesopotamia. For centuries, this area became a territory of foreign empires. Eventually, Mesopotamia would fade, like its kings, into the mist of history, and its cities would sink beneath the sands of Iraq. But its ideas would prevail in literacy, law, math, astronomy, and the gift of civilization itself.
The Sumerians are given credit for the invention, basically, of writing. We date them to around 3000 BC. You see Hammurabi. Hammurabi's a Babylonian. And, of course, you probably have heard of or maybe somewhat familiar with Hammurabi's law code. That stone with the code on it and the picture at the top, I believe, is at the Louvre in Paris, if you've been to Paris.
Light.
And so you can actually go and see it. That dates to around 2000 BC, around the time of Abraham, that Hammurabi in Babylon is kind of at its peak. And so we're going to go 1,000 years. Sumer and Akkad, and then the Akkadian Empire will subdivide, as it mentioned, into Assyria and Babylon, and really the rise of the first Babylonian Empire. Over 1,000 years. And we don't have a ton of information, a ton of knowledge about that time frame. We simply know that it was an age of development, agriculture, law, language. The cuneiform clay that you saw there was probably an Akkadian. That's a lot of students of ancient Near Eastern linguistics start there. And I didn't have any Akkadian. It's supposed to be incredibly difficult. But that's kind of where our study of human language begins, in the Western world at least. For Mesopotamia, if you go to modern-day Baghdad in Iraq and go Baghdad south, you're going to get mostly Babylonian territory. The ancient city of Babylon is going to be south along the river. You may have seen when it was tracking out cities, if you go Baghdad north, you would have seen the city of Ashur and the city of Nineveh. So Baghdad south is largely the region of Babylon. Baghdad north is largely the region of Assyria. And it was all city-states. It wasn't like a big, you know, nation. There were city-states, but the closer to the Persian Gulf you get, the more agriculturally friendly your land is. More barley, more wheat. That means more bread, more beer, more fish. The further north you get, cooler climate, higher elevation, you get other resources. And so the two parts of Mesopotamia between Assyria and Babylon would constantly kind of eye each other across the country and think, if we had their resources, it sure would help us out a lot. And that's the reason why they would kind of jockey back and forth. It's a huge world. And if you have gone to Israel, If you go someday, if you're going on this trip, you'll have the opportunity to see the Mediterranean Sea, the rise of the mountains in the center part of Israel, the coastal plain, the Jordan River Valley, and how fertile all of this land is for what amounts to about, how wide is it? Stephen, do you remember? 30 miles from the Mediterranean to the Jordan River? It's not terribly wide. And then when we go into Jordan, you'll see how so much of the inhabited part of Jordan is really close to the Jordan River Valley, and then you get very far into Jordan and it's desert, sparse landscape. And you can understand why starting, you know, probably even before Abraham, this little land bridge between Mesopotamia and Egypt was highly sought after. Everybody wanted to control it, because if you controlled it, you controlled trade. It would be like if you could corner the market, if you could eliminate all of the other air travel companies, and you could be the only air travel company, how lucrative would that be? This was the primary means of transport of goods and travel in the entire known world at that time. And to get from south to north or north to south, he had to travel through what is modern-day Israel. It was very strategic, and people are going to fight over it, from the Egyptians to the Babylonians to the Greeks to the Romans, to still fighting over it today. And so Mesopotamia is important, obviously not so much for our trip, but this is the land of Abraham. Abraham is born and raised in this world. We don't know exactly where his hometown was. It speaks about him being from Ur of the Chaldeans. Chaldeans, kind of another word to speak of the Babylonians, but we actually have two cities that have been identified as Ur. And so we don't know which one Abraham was from. One is pretty far down in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, which would have been deep into Babylon. The other one is a little bit further over, kind of what would be close to modern-day Damascus, maybe modern-day Syria. Whatever the case may be, this was Abraham's world. Abraham was a Mesopotamian, and he's going to come out of that area to go wandering into the region of the Levant as a nomad, because God mysteriously tells him to go, and he's going to bring all of his culture and religion and language of the Mesopotamian world with him. This is where Abraham and the Israelites, though they were born out of Mesopotamia. And so it has a significant place for us from a biblical historical point of view. You track through the Old Testament, you see Nineveh represented there. Obviously, that's well known for us from the account of Jonah. The exile of the Israelites when the Babylonians destroy Jerusalem, they're going to trek all the way from Jerusalem to Babylon and probably follow that Fertile Crescent north to Damascus and then up to the Tigris-Euphrates and then all the way down tracking the rivers until you get to Babylon, which is much further south in Mesopotamia. So this region will factor in a lot in our biblical understanding of history, but a really important part of it is understanding the juxtaposition between Assyria and Babylon and their kings and their cities, because they'll be major, major players throughout the history of the Old Testament for sure. Comments or questions on Mesopotamia before we move over to Egypt? If you're on Facebook Live, you could do the same thing. In fact, there may be a link next to Mesopotamia 101. National Geographic has one. Is it Egypt 101 or is it Ancient Egypt 101? Ancient Egypt 101. Search that. Should be a little 6-minute video that's going to do much the same for us as this one did, but tracking Egypt. So if you guys would, roll that one for us next.
At its height, Ancient Egypt's empire stretched as far north as modern-day Syria and as far south as today's Sudan. But long before it was an empire, ancient Egypt was a series of small, independent city-states that bloomed along North Africa's Nile River. The city-states were divided into two regions and named according to the flow of the Nile: Upper Egypt in the south, which was upstream, and Lower Egypt in the north, which was downstream. By about 3100 BC, the two halves united, thereby creating one Egyptian state that lasted for millennia. The reign of this civilization can be divided into three major periods of prosperity, called the Old, Middle, and New Kingdoms, and two periods of instability in between, called the First and Second Intermediate Periods. Guiding the Egyptian people was a succession of about 300 rulers, often referred to as pharaohs. Pharaoh, which means great house in Egyptian, was never the ruler's formal title. It only became synonymous with the ruling individual in modern times, thanks to its use in the Hebrew Bible. These rulers, who were not always men, nor Egyptian, were considered protectors of the people and served as divine liaisons between humanity and the hundreds of gods they worshipped. After the rulers passed away, ancient Egyptians believed they then became gods. To prepare their journey into the afterlife, the rulers constructed elaborate tombs, including the Great Pyramids at Giza and underground mausoleums in the Valley of the Kings. Rulers filled their tombs with all the items they could need in the afterlife, including gold, jewelry, food, drink, and even pets. Preparing for this journey to the gods also involved mummifying one's body. The deceased's corpse was embalmed, wrapped in hundreds of yards of linen, and placed inside the tomb so the body could be reanimated in the afterlife. To this day, structures like the Great Pyramids are a testament to the role of religion in ancient Egyptians' lives. But they also represent the innovative and cultural might of the Egyptian people. Innovations in mathematics and written language in particular propelled their civilization to success. Math, specifically measurement mathematics, helped Egyptians understand and harness their world with numbers like no other civilization had before. They developed a new form of measurement called the cubit. It was used to design massive structures, such as the Great Pyramid, with remarkable geometrical precision. The Egyptians also measured time. By combining mathematics with astronomy, they established a 24-hour division to the day and created a solar calendar, which was the first dating system in history to feature 365 days in one year. Lastly, Egyptians developed methods to measure and survey land around the Nile River. These civil engineering feats made way for the construction of dams, canals, and irrigation systems that helped farming and agriculture to flourish in the Nile Valley. In addition to mathematical concepts, the ancient Egyptians also created written languages to describe the world around them. The oldest and probably most well-known of these is hieroglyphic writing. This system was developed around 3150 BC during the Old Kingdom and has over 700 pictorial characters. It was used to inscribe monuments and pottery and predominantly served a decorative or ceremonial purpose. Soon after, another ancient form of writing, called hieratic, developed out of the hieroglyphic system. It was a form of cursive that was written in ink and served a more functional purpose. Unlike its more formal predecessor, hieratic was written on another ancient Egyptian innovation, papyrus. Papyrus was a type of paper derived from the papyrus plant, which grew plentifully along the Nile River. This medium gave the ancient Egyptians a new avenue of communication and record keeping that allowed their civilization's administrative skill to grow and their culture to spread for thousands of years. As with all great empires, ancient Egypt came to an end. It was eventually conquered after a series of invasions, including those by the Persian Empire in the 4th century BC and the Roman Empire around 30 BC. Not many civilizations can claim a lifespan of over 3,000 years, let alone one that made vast cultural contributions that still resonate in modern times. Ancient Egypt, with its linguistic and mathematical innovations, spirituality and religion, and extensive political and military might, set a high standard for all civilizations that followed.
Whereas it's a tough travel trip to make it to modern Mesopotamia, it's becoming a little bit easier and easier to get back into modern Egypt. We inquired as to this trip about doing an extension into Egypt instead of Jordan. There's so much in Egypt to see and do that we opted not to do that, but we're considering probably the next trip we do, maybe a year or 2 years down the road, to be an exclusive Israel trip. The travel agent we work with said they do 9-10 day trips solely in Egypt, and they include a Nile River cruise, they include Cairo, they include obviously trips to the Valley of the Kings and the Pyramids of Giza. And so if you haven't traveled on any of our trips, or if you're not making the Israel trip this year, you might want to keep that in mind, that we may try and do Egypt in the near future. So it's interesting, really, when you look at, you know, we, from a biblical point of view, we make so much out of Israel. And from a spiritual point of view, a faith point of view, Israel's legacy to the rest of the world, even still today, is a religious one. But you look at Mesopotamia and Egypt, how many contributions did they make that have affected everything else in our cultural world? From time, you know, to our calendar, to agriculture, to architecture, to engineering, to law, you know, really, really significant. And a lot of times when you read the Bible, we simply identify Egypt as the land of slavery and the evil Pharaoh, and we identify Babylon as the land of, you know, the land of exile and the land of destruction of the Israelites. But these two places, apart from them, you know, being different when it comes to religion and the gods that they worshipped, were significant in the rise of human civilization. They contributed greatly, and it really makes almost, you know, it makes Israel or the Levant seem pretty small. If you were to track Egypt today, what you'll find is that the land along the Nile is very, very fertile, and if you get very, very far away from the river, you're back in desert. You know, Egypt is largely inhabited right along that Nile River Valley that you saw on the map when they pulled it up. And we won't see that on this upcoming trip, but you'll see a similar quality in Jordan. Jordan, when it's close to the Jordan River, is green, is, you know, habitable, is arable, and then you get very far away from the river and you've just kind of moved into desert territory. So if another thing I wanted to point out, on the calendar, we divide Egypt's history into Old Kingdom, Middle Kingdom, New Kingdom. The Old Kingdom, I mean, that entire history transpires before we get to the time of Abraham. And so you have a whole 500 years of what we study and measure in Egypt's history that that doesn't really come into contact with the biblical narrative at all. We really enter into, Egypt becomes an entity with the Middle Kingdom, and you also see a nice break there between Middle Kingdom and New Kingdom and the second intermediate period. The transition, there's a lot of debate, not debate, a lot of conversation about Joseph going into Egypt, and then we transition to the book of Exodus, and it says a new Pharaoh had come who did not know Joseph or Joseph's family, that a lot of that, probably the enslavement of the Israelites, the transition from a Pharaoh who embraced Joseph to a Pharaoh who would imprison Moses and his generation of Israelites, probably a lot of that moving parts would take place in the outgoing of the Middle Kingdom, the second intermediate period, and the coming in of the New Kingdom. And we don't know exactly when all those events transpired, but right there, 1600 to, you know, 1400, 1300 is the same time frame that we're looking at when we look at the Exodus and the events around the life of Moses. So it kind of helps see some overlap and gives maybe some credence to the biblical story for historians who are looking for evidence apart from just the biblical record. Egypt's history studied on its own does line up a little bit with the story of the Old Testament as the Israelites connect with the Egyptians there. So, questions or comments on Egypt? Any of you guys been to Egypt? Anybody been? Yeah, a number of you. As much as a decade ago, I think it was relatively safe and very, very popular for travel. And with the revolution that happened there, travel agents and, you know, stopped sending people there. Americans kind of tended to stop going there. And our travel agent that we work with, it's a large company in the Midwest. They do a lot of religious tours. So they sent their first teen group back into Egypt this past year for the first time in a decade, and said that the group had a fantastic experience. I think the country is building, this feels like an exaggeration, but I think what I heard is a $1 billion museum at Giza. And I think Marriott has gone in and has built a very, very nice kind of resort hotel in Cairo. And so Egypt is taking seriously their location in the history of mankind, their place as a tourist destination for historical purposes, and they want people to come. And the sentiment that our travel agent said was the Egyptians, when they saw American tourists or tourists of any kind, when they saw them there, they were kind, they were warm, they were so happy to see people coming to their country again to see them. And so whether you go on a trip with us or whether you travel on your own, you book your own trip over there, it seems to be a much safer and more welcoming place than it has been just in recent history. So, yes, ma'am. Oh, really? The last plane out of Egypt. What year was that, Judy? The uprising was 2010? 2009. Okay. Yeah, so about a decade ago. And so that leaves us with the Levant in the middle. Syria, Lebanon in the north. Canaan, Israel, Palestine in the south. We're going to look a little bit more at the regions of Israel, Palestine, next week. And so we'll look at Jordan River Valley, the mountains, the Jezreel Valley, some of the moving parts within the country. Israel is pretty remarkable in that in a territory not much bigger than the state of South Carolina, you go at the Dead Sea to 200 feet below sea level, and you track the Jordan River up to Mount Hermon, which is on the border between Israel and Syria. I think Mount Hermon is at about 8,000 feet above sea level. You have desert in Israel. You have arable land. You have mountains. You have lush valleys. You have the Mediterranean coast. You have the Jordan River Valley. It's one of the more diverse geographical places in the world. And that speaks to, that tells us a great deal about why it's so important in our own history. I wanted to put this one up. Yeah, thanks, Mike. This is, it tracks the main highways or main modes of travel in the ancient world. The two big roads that you'll hear about, one of them is indicated on here in green. Goes all the way down to Thebes in the upper Nile region. You have to remember the upper and lower is reversed because of the flow of the Nile. All the way down, this green road is referred to as the Via Maris in Latin. The Romans would refer to it as the Via Maris, the way of the sea, or sometimes referred to as the International Coastal Highway. The coastal highway would track all the way along the Nile through Egypt, cut across along the Mediterranean, track all the way up through what is modern-day Israel. And then at the northern point where you, that's not the northern point, where you see the red square, you kind of see it where the red line and the green lines meet, that's the city of Damascus. Damascus is also going to be a very important city in the ancient world, and today is still the capital of Syria, right? Is the capital city? Does anybody know? I think that it is. Damascus, and then it tracks up north to where it meets the Euphrates River, then follows the Euphrates River all the way down to the Persian Gulf. The International Coastal Highway, this was the, you know, they didn't have tons and tons of roads, but this was the way of travel. And you can see it cut right through the heart of Israel. The other road, lesser traveled but sometimes well familiar, is marked by the Red Line. And it simply goes from, I don't remember the name, the right bunny ear on the Red Sea. That's my very technical geographical description. Tracks through Sinai and then follows along the east side of the Dead Sea and the Jordan River through what is today modern-day Jordan and then connects at Damascus. That's referred to as the King's Highway. So the International Coastal Highway and the King's Highway were the major thoroughfares in the biblical world for travel between Egypt and Mesopotamia. And, you know, whenever David and Solomon were kings, they controlled both of them. They controlled both of them. It helped make Israel as wealthy as it was during its golden period because anything moving from north to south and south to north, Israel profited from. And not only did they profit from it, but they also had access to all the goods and services that might move in between those two countries. So if you wanted beer from Mesopotamia, you could get it. If you wanted gems or stones or gold from the very, very southern part of Egypt, regions that would now be identified as Sudan, you could get those too. If you wanted cedars from Lebanon, you had easy access to that. If you wanted anything that could come off of the sea from sea traders, that's the other routes you see on the map, the blue routes, you know, from the Mediterranean world, the Aegean world. Israel is a place where you could, you know, you could get just about anything because anything and everything passed through there. And it made it prime territory for lots of reasons. So this kind of hopefully gives you a big picture. And this is really, as it's the first chapter in the book. It's as much as I wanted to get through tonight, because once we start digging into the geographical landscape of Israel proper, we'll need more time than just the 10 minutes that we've got remaining tonight. So unless anybody else had questions or comments, we'll kind of wrap up. If you are, A, if you're going on the trip, or B, if you just like reading books, the last two times that I've taken folks to Israel, I've recommended a book called Walking the Bible. It's written by, I believe a journalist is his trade, named Bruce Feiler. I think his last name is spelled F-E-I-L-E-R, Bruce Feiler. Not a Christian, but he is Jewish. And it's kind of a travelogue. He set up a goal of going to the Middle East, and he wanted to travel the story of Genesis through Deuteronomy. And so he goes up into Turkey to the place where they have claimed, you know, Mount Ararat is, where Noah's Ark landed, works his way through Iraq, but spends a great deal of time in Sinai, a great deal of time in Israel, visiting locations and sharing some of his stories from a modern perspective on his experience traveling. And so when I travel places, I like to read a little bit before I go to give me a different perspective. And so the book has been out 20 plus years. It should be inexpensive to get, easy to get. If you're a reader, then it's an easy read. So, and Pat has it in the library. You got one copy, or do you have multiple copies? Yeah, right. Walking the Bible was kind of his first one and put him on the map, and then it was so well received, I think he did more. Yeah, did more of that. Okay. Yeah. I recommend it. I think it's worth the time, especially if you're going to be making the trip. So how many of you, I'm gonna have Garrett place an order for copies of the Holman Bible Atlas. How many of you would like us to take care of that for you? Hold your hands up and I'll count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 on this side of the room. 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I have 11. I'll have him order a dozen in case somebody shows up next week that might have missed out. So a dozen copies, and we'll have them next week. Okay? Thank you guys for being here. We will meet at 6 next week, probably start about 6:05, and we'll look at the geographical region of Israel. Okay? See you Sunday.